This is George Hemmen, recorded by Chris Eldon Lee on the 8th of November, 2010. George Hemmen, Part 1.
The name is George Ethelbert Hemmen. You got the spelling of all that, I guess.
Ethelbert?
Yes.
As in the king?
As in the king. The date of birth is the 1st of March, 1926. Long time ago, and I was born in West London.
Did your father have aspirations for you then, naming you after a former monarch?
No, it was my mother's father's Christian name. And she was very fond of him. So that's how that came. My father's name was George, so that bit, the Ethelbert was Granddad's name.
Well, you're the first Ethelbert I've met.
Probably.
As far as I know. And
probably the first Hemmen you've met, too.
Well, that's also true. Yeah. Where does that come from?
We don't know. We really don't know. As a guess, probably a little town in Holland called Emmen. E-M-M-E-N. Right. But.
And what was your childhood like? Were you privately educated or did you go to the state school?
No, I went to the Latimer Upper School in Hammersmith. But don't forget, this was during the war years. I left there and I left school 12 months or so. Then I went into the army. Then after the war finished, I saw a little point in staying in the infantry, so I transferred to something more directly interesting, but not, you know, from a fighting point of view, and I went across to the Royal Artillery and trained as a surveyor.
Just go back to the war years for a moment. Infantry suggests you might have seen active service.
No. We were ready for it, but that was it.
Okay.
That was I was in the King's Royal Rifles then.
Right. Tell me about learning to be a surveyor then.
It was something. I mean, I've always been interested in the outdoors and maps and such like things, and there was this opportunity to go and be trained as a surveyor, which I thought would be kind of useful and interesting thing. And we went to the Royal Artillery Survey School in on Salisbury Plain. Can't remember how long that took, but then I got my surveyor's badge. That was fine.
Can you recall where your fascination for maps sprang from?
Not really. Probably during the war years when I was in the school Army Cadet Corps.
What would have been your first brush with the Antarctic, your first appreciation that such a place existed?
Oh, I had read various articles for people who had been there, and I was quite interested, and then it was in 1952. There was this advert in the Daily Telegraph or Times or something for FIDS. And I applied and went up for an interview. And the only positions they had available were as Met Observer. And they sent us up to the Met Office Training School in Stanmore. And that was it. Then we went down on, sailed south first time on the old wooden John Biscoe.
How old were you then?
Oh, it must have been, 25, 26, something like that. Mid-20s, anyway.
What do you recall of the selection process? Do you remember who was interviewing you?
Yes, indeed. There was Sir Miles Clifford, who was the Governor of the Falkland Islands. There was the Secretary of FIDS, people from Colonial Office.
Was Bill Sloman around in those days, or was it before his time?
I came across Bill Sloman. I don't think Bill Sloman was involved in, that I'm aware of anyway, because I wouldn't have known who the people were apart from the ones I had direct contact with in the immediate future, like Governor and Secfids and so on. Bill, I came across, of course, during the IGY Halibay set up. He was on the committee, then on the personnel committee.
Interesting that Clifford should be at your interview. You're the first FID I've met who remembers him being on the interview panel, so you must have come back to the UK for that, I guess.
Oh, yes, yes. I'm pretty sure he was.
Was it an easy afternoon, or did he have to work hard at the interview?
No, I didn't find it too difficult. It went quite relatively easily. And sort of odd questions like, why do you want to go to the Antarctic, is something you really can't answer. I mean, there isn't an answer to that.
No, 50 years later, there's still not an answer.
No, you must be mad.
So did you then undergo any training before you were packed off to the Antarctic?
You mean physical training?
Any kind of training?
Well, only, as I say, we had the Met Office training school.
Oh, yeah, sorry.
But apart from that, no, not at all.
Crevasse rescue?
No. You learnt that the hard way in those days. You had sort of the medical, very serious medical check and dental checkup. They remove all your fillings and replace them to make sure you don't have any trouble when you're down there, which is fine. Nothing more than that. You just wait. What I would say, though, is that, I don't know, there must have been a dozen and a half or a couple of dozen of us on this little wooden boat in very cramped conditions. But it was very good in as much as it sorted people out. That long voyage down the Atlantic, the quirks of people come out in this little closed community, and you get a pretty good idea who, under no circumstances, would you want to spend a winter with.
Do you think you were being observed whilst you were travelling south by anybody who was going to distribute the men?
No, only perhaps the ship's captain.
Who was, do you remember his name in those
days? Yeah, Bill Johnson.
Was Bill Johnson?
Oh, yeah, it was indeed.
What do you make of him?
Great guy. Oh, yeah, he knew his stuff all right.
Can you elaborate a little?
He had this bluff exterior, but I think we got on very, very well. And once the ship got down into, even before that, when the ship was in bad weather, I tell you, you had great confidence that he knew what he was doing, and certainly once it got into the ice, he was great. But it was a funny little ship.
Tell me about the ship. What was it called?
John Biscoe.
The original one?
The original John Biscoe, yes. Yes, it was a wooden, a wartime net layer. I've got a picture of it if you want to see it.
Was it a bit of a squeeze?
It was very much of a squeeze. It was, I know you're talking about a few hundred tons, that's all. Quite small. In fact, when you first saw it at Southampton, you think, oh, that must be the tender that's going to take us out of the ship. But it wasn't.
How did it handle it at sea?
Like a pig.
Really? Yeah.
Well, yes, because it had no keel. It had just had a couple of rubbing strakes on the side, so, of course, there was nothing to stabilise it at all. In Biscay, she was rolling 55 degrees each side of the vertical every 5 seconds. Now, that's unmoving.
Were you relaxed at this point?
No, far from it. No, we were not at all well, most of us. You just lie in your bed and hope it'll all soon end.
I would imagine you hadn't done much sailing in the Royal Artillery, so...
No, not at all. No. No. Only small, you know. In fact, I hadn't done any sailing whatsoever. Till then. But it was a good voyage. And it's, as they say, it's sorted people. And then we stopped at, we stopped at Cape Verde Islands for refuelling, then on to Montevideo, a couple of run ashore, then down to Stanley. Stanley was an interesting place. You've been there?
No, I haven't, but tell me what it was like in 1953 or so.
Oh, well, very back and beyond. There were roads there, and a couple of shops and a couple of pubs, and they had there was a dance in the local town hall once a week or something like that. But it was all corrugated iron roofs, even the government house and the cathedral. It was very, very primitive, and but it was very nice, and the people were very welcoming. And that was really where all the FIS headquarters were in those days. That's where all the staff. The London office of FIS in those days consisted of one secretary only, and that was it. The rest were all down in Stanley.
Did you come across Fuchs at this point?
Yes, indeed. I think he was. Fuchs was director of the FID Scientific Bureau. He may have been on our interview panel. I think he probably was. Mm. But the introduction, if you like, once we were all signed up and we were doing this Med Office course. We all went up to Cambridge for a day, and Bunny sort of introduced us to, you know, the things that how it was going to be, and he was very good.
This was the Girton College conference.
No, it was in Scotpola.
Oh, was it?
Yeah, in Scotpola.
So, how many would you say there were of you in those days?
Oh well, I think on that party, I don't know. Dozen or so, you know, not terribly many.
And what happened when you got to Stanley, George? What were the
you were kitting out and briefing and get told where you're going to go, because we hadn't been allocated bases until that time. And then off we went. A few days later, South Georgia. I spent a couple of days in South Georgia, and then no, did we go to South Georgia? No, we didn't. Not at that time. We went straight down south. The first call was Hope Bay, then Admiralty Bay, and that was quite good. The leader, the base leader from the previous year, stayed over the summer, and then there were the four new people, but there was a building program going on with the carpenter from Port Stanley, and we were engaged in adding bits to the hut, essentially. And then the ship, what can I tell you about it? Not a lot. The summer was an enjoyable summer. Things were happening, and of course, there's that famous boat trip incident. we had an Argentine tug came in one day. Anyway, come the end of the season, Bisco left, and winter set in, and you settle down to your routine.
Well, that's before we talk about the famous boat trip. This is the one that didn't quite work according to plan, I presume, is it?
That's right, yeah.
Just tell me a bit about the meteorological setup. In this was 53/54, wasn't it?
No, 50. It was winter 53.
Winter 53.
Yeah.
Well, how sophisticated, shall we say, were the Met Office?
Not very. It was pretty basic Met observing that we were doing down there. The odd balloon ascent, followed by a theodolite, but basically it was Met Obs every X hours. There was 1, 2, 3 of us, 3 Met people, a diesel mech and a radio operator, and that was it. That was a wintering complement of the base, just five.
Did you take satisfactorily to metrology?
I think so.
Yeah.
I think so. It was interesting. One of the tricky things was, you know, you have to judge the height of cloud. Okay, the guesswork. But no, it was okay. That was fine. You know, you were doing a job of work, and that's what you were there for. And the observations were sent off by radio a couple of times a day. No, it was a very good winter, I would say.
Did you feel at the time that the work you were doing was really worthwhile? It was doing something. A major contribution to science at the time. And looking back on it, do you still feel the same way?
Right, let me try and see how I can answer that one. It certainly wasn't a major contribution to science. It was a simple, straightforward meteorological observing station, and that's what we were doing. We were sending the observations in and, of course, writing them up. It was satisfying in that respect, but, of course, we did. We travelled about quite a bit. It was interesting, and it was a fascinating time. Thoroughly enjoyed it. Mind you, you've got to remember that if there's just five of you on a little station, surviving takes quite a lot of time.
Can you elaborate on that for me?
Well, you've got to do your own cooking and mending and washing and cleaning and getting food for the dogs and feeding the dogs and looking after them and all that sort of thing. It takes time.
Hmm. Were there any surprising weather results or any particular extreme weather that you recorded?
No, not really. I mean, you get your ration of storms and gales and days when you can't see a hand in front of you, but then on other occasions you get a brilliant blue sky and calm, no wind, and life is absolutely wonderful. Well, I've got a lovely picture somewhere of one of these days when the sun was shining and there was no wind, and the hut was fairly well drifted up, and we strung a line between the chimneys and hung our washing out to dry. And of course it froze solid, but it didn't matter, it still evaporated. But it's a lovely picture, there's the blue sky behind it all.
So when he brought it in, it was dry, was it?
Oh, yeah.
So it froze solid and then it dried out, and...
Yeah.
So you got the ironing done at the same time?
Well, more. I don't think we bother with ironing very much.
No, ironing and fizz doesn't equate to
No, it doesn't.
Do you think you were also, again, you might know more about this now than then, but do you think you were also aware at the time of the political game that was going on?
Oh, yes. I mean, quite.
That was obvious, wasn't it?
That was a very large part of why fizz existed, wasn't it?
And that had been explained to you at the time?
It must have been, because we were certainly aware of it. I mean, it was a factor. No question about that.
Tell me about this slightly unfortunate boat trip then. This is briefly described in Ice and Men.
Yeah.
But I'd love to hear a more detailed version from your...
Well, it was just one of those things. There were four of us. It was one of these beautiful summer days. And there was a penguin rookery, a big penguin rookery, on a point, it was about 6-7 miles from the base. Mm. And there was an emergency food and fuel dump maintained there. Now, you have to go and look at these emergency dumps every once a year or something, make sure they're all in order. And it was an opportunity to collect eggs, which, of course, they can't do anymore. And the four of us went across and checked the dump, collected our eggs, had a very nice time. And then when we came to launched the boat to go back late that afternoon, the wind had got up, but we hadn't noticed it because where we were was quite sheltered and the sea was just too rough to get back. So we were stuck there for 2 or 3 days.
How well equipped were you for staying the night?
Not at all well equipped. Because, I mean, it was black. We had food, we had paraffin, we had cigarettes, and that was about it. We upturned the boat and propped it up on some cases, and that was our shelter. It was really quite uncomfortable, but you were stuck with it.
Were you having to hang on to that boat?
Once the wind did get up underneath it and tipped it over, and then we sort of re-anchored it and held it all down with old whale bones. But that was fine. And then, a couple of days or so, it seemed to be calming down. So, and this is where it all sort of went wrong. The boat was in... There was a sort of a shelter, if you like, of a few rocks out at sea. And it looked as though it was fairly calm. So two of us said, OK, look, we'll take the boat out beyond this sheltered bit, around the corner, which is where the bad weather was, and see what we make of it. And at worst, we'll have to come back. So anyway, we took the boat round the corner. It didn't seem too bad. So, well, it was OK, it was still a bit of a sea running, but we thought it wasn't that bad, let's go for it. So we went into the shore to pick the other two up, and then all of a sudden one of these katabatic gusts, woof, came down, by which time, of course, we were on a lee shore, so we had to get out, and we were going to try and go back around to our little sheltered bay, but by that time the wind had just come out of absolutely nowhere. And we were riding on it, and in fact I was driving the boat at the time, and there was just no way that I could turn it across the waves. It would have been over, so you had to just run with the tide. But the trouble there was that it was the waves were taking us out into the Bransfield Strait. Every time we got up on top of a wave, I'd push the tiller over and try and ride along on top of it, inch our way to the left. Anyway, we ran, I suppose, about 5 miles across and eventually got across the other side. We didn't go out to the Bransfield Strait, but the people in the bay said, we were watching all this with them on the odd light. They saw something happening. And that was really about the run of it. Very unpleasant.
You weren't one of the most experienced boatmen in the Antarctic at that point, were you?
No,
so?
No.
It was the instinct that was driving you to do the right thing?
Yes, purely. And I was glad I was driving it because I had something to think about.
At one point, you had to leave. You put out a message in the snow,
yeah,
with stones. I think it was with stones, which read "Boat okay."
Yeah.
I can't quite interpret that message. What did it mean?
Well, what it meant was that as we were crossing the bay, this forced crossing, which we hadn't wanted to do, but you couldn't turn the boat, so you had to go with the tide. And once we got across the other side, we were on a point which, if we went across, if you know, walked across this little point, there was a nice snowfield, more or less facing the hut. Now, we knew they'd got the theodolite there, we knew they'd got binoculars, so we just got some rocks and said, oh, you know, just to let them, if they could read it, in great big boulders set against the snow, boat okay.
Which meant that your boat was fine?
Yeah.
Not sure. Here's a please send a boat.
No. It meant, what we meant was we're okay and we'll be back as soon as the
So it was a reassurance message rather than an SOS.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
But somebody sent out an SOS at some point because the ship turned up.
Yeah.
The snipe.
Yeah. Well, yes, I mean, as soon as we were stuck for the night, they told Stanley, and then they saw us going across, I suppose, and anyway, snipe came in and sent a motorboat out. It was a bit, well, pissed you off a bit, quite honestly, because another hour and we'd have been on our way because the wind was dropping again. We'd have got back all right. But by this time, well, when we got back, I mean, can you imagine living under this upturned boat? We had cigarette tins, which we filled with paraffin, stuck a bit of string in the top, and that was our lamp. Now, it gives all quite a lot of sooty muck, and we're absolutely filthy. So I don't know what the crew of the snipe thought when they saw us, but there we are. Anyway, that was it.
What were your feelings about being rescued? Were you slightly indignant?
Yes, as I say, pissed off. We would have got back all right, eventually.
Did you at any time fear for your life?
I didn't, no. As I say, don't forget, I was pretty busy.
Mm.
My guess is some of the others did.
And when the ship came to get you, what I'm trying to avoid putting words into your mouth because that's not the thing to do. But then did they present an attitude? Were they delighted to have rescued you, or fed up that you'd detoured the boat?
I don't think so. No, I mean, it was all quite friendly. They sent a motorboat out, and the motorboat towed us back. We went up to the hut and. They couldn't stop very long because they were off to do something else. No, it was all quite amicable and friendly. And
So there were no hard feelings that the base commander had sent out an SOS?
No, not really. Oh, you can't have hard feelings about these things, can you?
Do you think there were lessons learned? I mean, did practice change as a result of this?
No.
Near miss, shall we say?
No. It wasn't lack of planning, it wasn't lack of forethought, it wasn't anything that needed to be changed. It was just a salutary lesson that if you're mucking about with small boats in that part of the world, you really have to be very much aware that the weather can change in a flash.
I was thinking that you ran out of fuel, had to refuel the boat.
Only very, very, very close inshore. We got pretty well right away across, so we weren't in the really bad, rough sea by that time. I mean, we started off with the full tank.
Right, oh, I see, okay.
Oh, yeah, well, no, don't worry about that.
And the radio was US, is that right?
The radio was US. Oh, well, that was US from day one. Yes, it didn't work. I mean, funnily enough, when I knew you were coming, I scribbled the note. I wrote some notes about all this immediately afterwards. And I came across them fairly recently. And we did have a radio, but the transmitter wouldn't work. We could hear the bass, but we could.
Oh,
we
right, so it worked in one way, one direction.
Yeah.
Only. Okay.
But we couldn't transmit, which, of course.
So the base commander didn't sit down and say, right, this is how we avoid these things again?
No.
No.
Well, you can't, I mean, you know.
Yeah. And the fact that it was an exceptionally high tide, was that something that you would have been able to predict?
Oh, no, I don't think it wasn't a tide, it was wind.
Right.
It was a high wind that suddenly got up. And, of course, when you're dealing with these sort of ice-capped islands, you can get these katabatic winds just suddenly screaming down from nowhere.
One of the chaps on the boat was Roger Banks, who wrote a novel later on, The Unrelenting Ice.
Yeah.
What did you make of that?
Well, who was it? I was lent a copy of it, which I read, and I thought it was rather fun. You recognised a lot of the characters in it. I mean, I could put their real names to some of them. but, he'd written it with his tongue in his cheek, but there was a lot of truth in it. There was a lot of make-believe as well. Oh, Roger was quite a character.
In what respect?
He didn't suffer fools gladly, for a start. And, he was always willing, very willing to, whatever had to be done, Roger was there to help. And, he was away with the fairies most of the time. I think one of the things that I said when it was written up for the Bass Club newsletter about him, that he was convinced that his paintings of clouds would have been a far better record than all this dull records that appear in the Met logbook. You're probably right.
Did you spot yourself in the unrelenting ice?
Yes. Oh, yes. Quite a bit of it. It was mixed up with another. It was he'd mixed up, some of me and somebody else. So it wasn't that clear. But there was a lot of it that you did see.
I think when you were working on the base Admiralty, quite a lot of restoration and renovation work going on. And there's a chap called John Raymond.
Yeah, yeah.
Who was in charge of all that? Yeah. Is that correct?
Yeah. Well, Johnny was the chippy.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yes. What happened? I mean, that was there, but it needed a big extension building to it. And Johnny Raymond was a chippy who was sent down from the Public Works Department in Stanley. Great guy. Little fella. I had a lot of time for him, and it didn't matter what the weather was, he'd get on with it. And he got a bit of a wall up, and then a blow came and it got shifted. It didn't matter, he'd fix it somehow. And it was largely because of, we knew Johnny so well because he'd been, and his work, we got him as chief chippy for First Year at Halley Bay.
Right, I see.
Him and his brother-in-law were the two chippies.
Well, I want to spend some time talking about Halley Bay later on,
of course. Yeah, sure.
Okay, but I'll come back to that later on. Okay. Did you get much sledging done then at Admiralty Bay? Was it good for sledging?
It was. We got a bit done, but nothing terribly serious, I must say, because you can't get very far. You have to rely on sea ice, of course, to get you out of that little peninsula that we're on. We didn't. There, on these small met bases, there wasn't any what you would call serious long distance sledging. Mm. It was more recreational as much as anything.
And was the island surveyed before you got there?
Yes.
So you had maps already?
We did, yes, yes.
So your surveying training didn't actually come into play then?
No.
At that point?
No, right. Not at all. Not at all. It didn't. I mean, it was the sort of Admiralty charts of that part of the island that we use as much as anything. Mm.
So what are your abiding memories of Admiralty Bay then, bearing in mind that you're one of a very small number of FIDs who ever spent a winter there?
I thoroughly enjoyed it. We got out and about a lot, particularly Roger was a very great, and Lofty Wurzwick, who was the base leader, he'd already been with FIDs before, and we got out and about quite a lot. And, it really was a wonderful experience, and the wildlife and the scenery was just absolutely incredible. No, it was a good year, a really good year. And then the following year, of course, I moved on to Deception.
Had you signed up for two seasons?
Yeah.
And when did you find out you were going to be moved? Or did you volunteer? Or did you volunteer?
No. You just got a message on the radio. You're going. Your next year will be at Deception, and you'll be base leader.
Oh right. So that was how you found out you were going to be base leader.
Yeah.
I see. Were you surprised?
I suppose I was, really. Yes. Fine. Yeah. No, it was good. And then, of course, once we got there, then we had this notice that Norman Leppard and Dick Kenny were coming to remap the island, and of course we needed to provide the support for them, and it went very well.
Well, tell me about that process, because I think you were divided up into two parties.
Hmm.
And you had some external assistance as well. Tell me about that.
Dick and...
Norman.
Dick Kenny and Norman Leppard. I mean, they both did different parts of the island from time to time, but they had to be supported separately in the field, one way or another, and depending upon what they were doing. We either left them to get on with it on their own. They were mainly plane tabling, or you'd give them support if they were going to do any, mountain work. Like I went with Norman when he wanted to go up to the top of the Mount Pond, which was the highest spot on the island. And we went up there, and he wanted to do his tabling. That was interesting because. It's one of these silly things, you know. It happens. you flog up this ice slope up to the top of the mountain, all roped up with your ice axe in a loop of rope dangling from your waist. You get up there, you think, right, okay, we've got there. So what do? You throw the ice axe down into the ice, you just point first so it just sort of sticks there. It didn't. It just went zoink.
You went straight through?
Yeah. We were standing on a snow bridge on top of a crevasse. We didn't stay there very long. But, these things happen. But, of course, that was the summer after the fracas with the Argentines on Deception.
What did you learn about that, Wash, then? You were coming in as a new team. Were you warned? Were you given a warning or a briefing?
Well, yes. I mean, we knew about it. We knew what was going on the radio at the time in the 52, 53 summer. And now we're 53, 54 summer. We were fully aware of it. And also, there was a team of... Royal Marine Commandos put there with us just in case there was any more nonsense. But there wasn't. I mean, we got on famously with both the Argentinos and the Chileans.
Again, I'll come to those in just a moment, but I'm interested in the relationship with the Marines, because I think you had eight to ten men detachment from the Marines.
Yes, that's right.
How did you get on with them?
Wonderfully.
Did you work side by side?
Oh yes, we got on very well indeed. you sort of remind me of things, don't you?
I'm glad
one of the Marines had something. I can't remember what it was now, but I think he had a boil or something of that sort. And the doctor at Hope Bay, we were on the radio, and he said, "Right, you've got to give this guy." The symptoms, whatever it was, he needs a course of penicillin injection. Well, fine. And I can remember Conrad Edwards, who was the major, I said, okay, yeah, well, we got penicillin in the medical chest. There it is. No, he said, it's your penicillin, you've got to give it to him. I said, no, he's your guy, you've got to give it to him. So here was this Royal Marine sergeant, Well, what do? You've got neither of us ever injected anybody before. So what do? There you are. One of my sole claims to fame, I've stuck a needle in the backside of a Royal Marine commando sergeant and got away with it.
Tell me a bit about Con Edwards, because he was in charge of the Marines who were there.
That's right. Yes.
Well, tell me what you thought of him.
Oh, we got on famously. We got on very well indeed. And, of course, there was all this politicking nonsense going on. And sometimes we'd both go out to one of these Argentine or Chilean ships. And we did the nonsense and then had a party. I mean, that was the routine.
I'll come to that
in
a moment. The Marines were actually helping you surveying, weren't they? They were accompanying you.
Yes, yes. They were great as sort of support personnel for the two surveyors.
Why were they taking weapons with them when they went surveying?
Oh, I doubt they did. I don't know. I don't think they did.
No, Dick Kenny writes that they had a weapon in one hand and a survey tripod in the other.
Well, maybe they did. I wouldn't recall. I have no recollection of that.
Okay.
I suppose it wouldn't have struck me as being odd that a Marine would have a rifle with him.
I mean, you were surveying right around their huts, weren't you, at times?
You were getting at some distance, yes. Mm. Yeah. I can't really... I don't know. Maybe that was true, maybe it wasn't.
All right, doesn't matter.
I suspect a little imagination.
It's a very imaginatively written piece, I must say. He says you were all terribly unfit for this surveying job.
Who? The Marines?
No, you were. The FIDs.
I don't think they were. Okay. Well, I'll tell you something. We used to go from our base to get across to the Penguin Rookery on Deception Island. You have to go across a ridge and get down. And a bunch of the Marines said, "Where is this Penguin Rookery? We'd like to go and have a look." And we told them. And they came back knackered. So I don't think there was anything too bad about the fitness of our people.
And do you remember a particularly large explosion when they were trying to get rid of some ordnance?
To get rid of?
Some ordnance.
No.
Yeah? Okay.
No.
Fair enough.
No, we got on very well. In fact, I mean, we got on very well with the Marines, and I met Con Edwards in London that summer after we got back home.
How did he get on with the South Americans then, as you say? Because I'd love to hear, you wrote a very interesting report about relationships with the Argentinians and then with the Chileans. So, and it sounds like he had a different relationship with the different nations. And this is all to do with having to hand out notices to visiting ship's captains. So tell me the story behind that, George.
Oh, well, I mean, this was... don't forget, this was pre-International Geophysical Year. This was the... There was sort of Chile, Argentina and the United Kingdom all laid claim to the same sector of Antarctic, which included places like Deception Island. That island, there were three stations, ours, Chileans and the Argentinos. And whenever a ship came in, we were required by the government of the Falkland Islands to go and deliver this harbour regulations and notice to the captain. Well, okay, if it was an Argentine ship, and there were some pretty big Argentine transports came in. Mm. It was a big transport and tugs.
Yeah.
And the routine was more or less the same. You storm onto this ship with your regulations, and you were told that the captain was asleep. He'd, after his voyage, he got his head down and tough, he couldn't see you. So that leaves you in a bit of a spot. You hand this notice to the first officer, who says thank you very much, and then you storm off the ship in high dudgeon. The moment you step back into your dinghy, a little sailor comes running down the steps. The captain invites you back aboard for a drink.
Did you actually ever succeed in handing this envelope to?
Oh, yes.
You did?
We always handed it over, and the Chileans, of course, they had a different approach. You handed your protest to them, and they'd hand you one back.
Pre-written?
Oh, yeah. But the thing was, the job was done. You know, you'd done what you had to do. What happened after that was almost inevitably social. We got on very well with both the Chileans and the Argentines.
What was it? What was in this envelope that their respective governments would object to?
Oh, a protest about their presence and, as you say, the harbour regulations. And
was there a paragraph or a phrase in the harbour regulations which they couldn't accept? Was there something?
Yes, yes, a statement that this is a British sovereign territory.
Right.
And to them they said it's our sovereign territory. You're a stalemate, really.
One gets the impression that both sides knew it was a game.
Of course.
Yeah.
Of course. When you're down there, as I say, as people you get on very well, you have to do this nonsense. And in fact, when after 19... I'll tell you a little story, which I don't know whether you've ever heard it. But it was getting quite late in the season when one of the British Navy frigates came in. And she was tied up in Port Foster. I don't know what the purpose was. I can't recall the purpose of that visit. Anyway, a Chilean helicopter comes over and hovers. He didn't land. He actually hovered a foot or two off the ground. So I went out to see what this was. And it was the first lieutenant. He said, look, we're on our way home, but the Commodore wanted to bring MIPO in, that's their big transport, just to say farewell for the season. But, and pointed at he said, what do we do about that?
The British ship?
Yeah. And I said, I don't know, hang on. And I went out to the British ship and I had a word with the captain. And I said, look, you know, this is a purely social visit that they're planning to make. Can we sort of ignore the nonsense? And he said, well, if they're prepared to, so am I. So we go back, okay. And then they bring this thing out. Now, they had these two ships lined up side by side. And then it started. Oh, wow. First thing that happened, a football match between the two navies. And then the Chileans, for the end of the day, they'd laid on big barbecue all along the beach. So the British ship provided some grog. And this went on. And then we had a party up at the hut. It went on until the small hours of the morning. But it's fine. I don't suppose that's in the official record.
It
shouldn't be.
Well, no, I haven't read it anywhere. Although I'm not the least bit surprised. But I think the Chileans got on. You got on better with the Chileans. So I think the Chilean personnel have better English than the Argentinians. Is that right?
Yes, and I think it's true to say that the Chilean Navy is very Anglophile. Hmm. The Argentines, yes, we got on very well with them. And we went to visit them a few times at their station. We got on famously. Afterwards, when we came back from Deception Island, and I was back in the UK now in sort of early part of, well, sort of spring, I don't know what time we got back, left there about April 54, must have been back here, sort of June, July time, something like that. I had a very nice little letter from the Commodore of the Chilean fleet, and he'd asked the naval attaché in London to take me out to invite me over for lunch one day. You know, that's the level of the relationship. And similarly with the Argentines, Two of the captains of their ships, one was Rodolfo Panzerini, who became, he was an admiral in the end, and he was the vice president of SCAR. We got on very well indeed. In fact, we were great friends, and also with Luis Capuro, who was another one of their captains. He was became the hydrographer of the Argentine Navy, and then ultimately he went to Texas A&M University, and he was one of the early presidents of SCOR. Again, great friend. Well, I met him again, funnily enough, in 2008, by which time he was 90 and I was 80-something. but this was this Woods Hole 50th anniversary of SCOR.
Mm.
And, it was just like old times. Anyway, no, we've gone on to 2008 now.
No, that's fine, that's fine. Do you think the fact that both parties, all three parties, were in such an unusual and remote environment helped to foster the good relations? If you'd all met...
Oh, I'm sure it did.
...in central London, it wouldn't have been the same.
No, it wouldn't. But I'll do another little story on that line. At the time of the Falklands War, we had a SCAR meeting in Leningrad. And it just happened that I went down to the hotel reception desk the moment the Argentine delegation arrived through the front door. And I forget, we were having this conflict. And but the SCAR meeting was there to talk about science. It wasn't to talk about the war or anything like that. And we sort of looked at each other. A little tricky. Because you don't know how they're going to react. They didn't know how. You just go straight across, shake hands. You've known them for years. So why should things change? And this is one of the things that international science and international science program can ride above a lot of political conflict. And to my mind, over many, many years that I've worked for the Royal, this was one of the things that always seemed to me to be quite important, that people of different nationalities and different creeds and cultures can work together if they've got a common goal, despite all the political conflicts. But we've gone on too far.
So, well, just to finish off that episode in Hope Bay, a couple of...
No.
In Deception.
Yeah.
Just to finish off that episode in Deception, the Chileans found alternative water supply later on. They found they could get water in Pendulum Cove.
Well, that was where we were.
Oh, right.
That was our water supply.
So that was okay, was it, for sharing your water supply with the Chileans?
Well, that's what they all... Yeah, sure.
Right. And the reason why you wrote this report was to, in 1955, was to try and persuade the British government to abandon this policy of delivering harbour regulations to...
Let me have a look at that.
...South American ships. I'll read you it. I would respectfully submit that the delivering of harbour regulations to all ships anchoring in Whalers Bay might be discontinued. Or be left to the discretion of the base leader to decide whether the visit of any ship is in any way regarded as official or purely social.
Yeah.
Did he have any impact with your plea?
I've no idea. I have absolutely no idea.
I'll leave this with you when I go.
Oh, I'd love to read that. You mean I actually wrote that?
It would appear so. It's G.E. Hemmen. It has to be you.
It does, okay. Indeed.
Well, I'll leave that one with you.
That's great. Oh, well, I don't know what happened.
Tell me a bit more about Deception, then, the general things you were doing apart from eating beef and drinking Argentinian wine.
And Chilean wine. Yes.
You were there with Jim Shirtcliffe was there.
That's right.
Well, I suggest there's a fair bit of construction work going on.
Well, yes. Don't forget, the hut that we were living in was not a FIDS hut. It was an old whaler's hut, and it was huge. It was massive, great, big, long, it was very, very big. And very, very heavy timbers. And one of the things that Jim and I decided that we'd turn one of the rooms into a sort of a bar lounge, and with a dark room, because there wasn't a dark room there at the time. And so we set about doing that. No, Jim was great.
You struggled to keep the place warm, I read.
Well, yes, because it was so big. It was a big hut.
Mm.
And you can't have fires burning in every room. I mean, the kitchen was where most of the centre of life, if you like. It was a big kitchen. It was the size of this room.
Was it particularly mild or winter, or a particularly bad winter?
I think it was fairly normal winter.
Because there's talk of the dog bowl freezing inside the hut. So you're getting down below you're getting below zero,
yeah,
Celsius.
I suppose that's possible. Well, if it's written, it must have happened.
And it wasn't the best insulated hut, was it? There was drizzle.
Oh, no, well, it wasn't insulated at all. It was just sort of great slabs of timber. I don't think there was a double wall or anything like that. It was just... But it was all right.
You tried to improve the conditions whereby you were launching Met office balloons and also right. observing their departure. What were you trying to do there?
Well, I that was one of the routine tasks of any of these small Met stations. When you got a day that you could do so, you'd launch a balloon to trace the winds in the higher levels of the atmosphere, and you'd follow it with the odd light.
But what you did, as I understand it, is to actually improve the conditions of under which you were able to do that.
We probably built a shelter or something like that. Do you know, I don't remember that at all.
Okay.
I don't remember that.
But you cleared out part of the old lower generator shed.
Yeah.
And also you built a little observatory on the beach so that they could watch with a theodolite, you could watch the balloons descend.
Yeah. That's what I surmised, that we built a little shelter
right.
down there.
Okay. It is a long time ago, George, don't worry.
Yeah.
And it was the worst winter that anybody can remember at Deception for many, many years.
Oh, was it indeed?
Yeah.
You mean I wrote that? Or
you did? July. The months of June, July, August and part of September brought frequent temperatures around 0 degrees Fahrenheit.
Mm.
For instance, the mean August temperature was only 8 degrees Fahrenheit. So that...
Who wrote that?
Me, you did.
Or? I did.
I believe.
Or is that the Met report?
It's the general report.
Oh, right. Oh, well.
It actually hasn't got a signature at the end of it.
Oh,
but that's fine.
Then.
And the hut, there was snow coming into the windows, basically.
Oh, yeah. Yeah,
well. Yeah. So there was still work to be done.
Still work to be done.
Oh, do you remember the episode of the weather vane being damaged?
No, but I imagine it's quite likely.
Okay.
I know one thing that did get moved was our lighthouse. It was one ship came in once and said, you've got a red light showing over the entrance and a green light showing over the rocks.
Well, the wind had done that, had it?
No. Somebody had been up there and, well, I don't know, some had gone up there and... anyway, we went over and put it right.
So, obviously not much sledging at Deception, but...
No.
Fair bit of climbing, I think, wasn't there?
Oh, yes, there was quite a lot of... Well, you know, if you wanted to make, say, some ice observations out in the channel, you had to get up and... had to climb up on the... Yeah. But that was what we did. I mean, that was our recreation, really, getting out and quite a bit of skiing and...
So a couple of quick questions about that. Comparing it to Admiralty Bay, I mean, it's nothing like as attractive a space.
No,
as Admiralty Bay. Were you as happy there as you were at Admiralty, or was it a bit more doer or dour?
I think I would say it was a bit more doer. Yeah. But the summer months were quite fun with all the, you know, with the Chileans and the Argentinos and the ships coming and going and all that sort of thing. It was quite a busy old time. And the Marines were great.
When the British ship came in, there was a signal to you to come aboard as soon as it was anchored. Because there'd been some coded messages going on, apparently.
Oh, yeah.
Can you tell me about that?
Yes, I can. That's exactly what happened. I don't know. Is that something that was written there?
These are notes provided for me by Al Weirden.
Oh, well, OK. That's exactly what happened. As the ship came in, the light was going, and our radio operator read the message, which said, come aboard the moment I drop anchor. No, oh, please come aboard the moment I drop anchor. which I did, and the captain told me about these coded messages which have been flying about, and they were quite concerned because they couldn't read them, and they assumed that it was some naval thing that was, you know, being planned or something like that. It was just this mystery. I don't know whether this should be recorded or not. Maybe it shouldn't. But I said, well, why don't we go over and ask them?
The Argentinians?
Yeah. You can't do that. Well, why not? I mean, they'll either tell us or they won't. well, all right. I said, OK, I'll bring my boat. You know, we're not going in that thing. So, no, we're going in the ship's launch. So there's this fancy cutter with, you know, sailors up the front and all the rest of it. And there's the Argentine sailors along the bank saluting. Anyway, we got there. And the first thing they told us was what this was all about.
Which was what?
It was that they're... one of their ministers, either the Minister of Marine or the Minister of the Services, I can't remember which one, was coming on an official visit to the Antarctic Station. Simple as that.
So the Argentinian base spilled the beans about the coded messages?
Yeah, no problem.
Without batting an eyelid?
Without batting an eyelid. We didn't even ask them. Because, you know, they told us why they'd been so busy polishing the place up.
And that's a good example, I suspect, of local relationships
yes.
being different from those that the ship was experiencing in the wider world.
Yeah, indeed.
Yeah. Was the British naval captain, how did he react
to this? I think he was very impressed.
Did you find the duties of being a base leader onerous?
No. It was all really quite interesting.
Did he ever have to make a difficult decision?
No, only once. Oh, I don't know, I suppose you have little problems, but most problems get ironed out. But don't forget, of course, the base leader's a magistrate. I had a case once.
Did you?
Oh, yes.
Can you tell me?
Yeah, sure. One of the sailor off one of the ships had been caught killing a penguin in a not very pleasant way. And because it was on our soil, he had to be hauled up before the magistrate, which was me.
Right, carry on.
Well, we listened to all this and I forget, I don't know. I mean, what can you do? In all conscience. I mean, you couldn't say, okay, 10 days in the cells because we didn't have any cells. And I think he got a reprimand. But it was something that had to be done.
Would it have been taken seriously by all concerned?
I think it probably was, yes. Because, okay, in those were the days long before... conservation of nature and natural resources and all that sort of thing. And dogs were fed on seals and penguins, and we fed on seals and penguin eggs and all that sort of thing. But nevertheless, if you're going to kill an animal for food, no matter what it is, you do it as humanely as you possibly can, and you just, it cannot be tolerated that somebody would be brutal to even a little penguin.
Can you remember what he did?
No, I can't now. I really can't. But it was possibly picking it up by its feet and bashing its head on a rock or something of that sort, which observers took unkindly to, and the observers might have been ship's officers or something. I can't remember the detail of that, but that's what it was really all about.
So in terms of the hierarchy, the base leader actually had authority over the ship's captain in that instance, didn't he?
On things that happened on shore, yes. Hmm. Oh, yes. In that respect. I mean, it was the ship that asked us to do it. I don't think we'd have bothered. And I'm sure it was them. As a sort of little lesson to the rest of the crew, if you like. That's not the way to behave.
You left the Antarctic at the end of that time at Deception Island.
Yes.
With mixed feelings, or were you glad to get away, or...?
I think two winters had been enough at a time. But now we left there April. That was a bit of an airy journey back. You've heard about that one. Oh, well, we went to Hope Bay. Oh, Margot's coming back. You can come back and listen to this. Are you coming in? No, we were in Hope Bay on Biscoe. And the ice came in. But, well, first of all, there was a blow, and Bill Johnson put out a second anchor. But if you've got two anchors down, you tend to be drifting around, and they get a bit wound up.
Mm.
But then a load of ice came in, and we were absolutely stuck. The ship was being pretty well bashed by the ice. Anyway, it eventually all died down off, and the ice went out again. And by this time, of course, the two anchor chains were completely wound up. So and couldn't bring them aboard because it was still a little bit rough. So what Bill decided to do was to go round to Deuce Bay, which is just round the corner, which would be a nice sheltered anchorage. And you could have put a boat over the side to unwind these two anchor chains. That's fine. Great. Okay. Anchors aboard. Full speed. And by the time we got up to about 5 knots, the masts were whipping like fishing rods. What had happened was that all this grinding ice had just bashed up the propeller was bent. And the stern gland, which, you know, that's the gland that had all come adrift. And the highest speed he could do from there, Sydney to South Georgia, 4 knots max. Luckily, it was calm all the way. Then we had to go into dry dock in South Georgia and get it patched up. Which got us to Montevideo, and then they put some divers over the side, and they said, yeah, okay, it's okay to go back to the UK.
Great. Let's leave it there then, because I think I heard a kettle being warmed up.
Would you like some tea?
I'd love some. We'll come back and do some more in a moment or two.
Okay, all right.
Thank you.